Support for the Think Podcast comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. You can register online now for the upcoming fall programs at smu.edu/CAPE.
The super wealthy make for an easy target. It's not hard to imagine how sweet life could be with a private plane and multiple homes and a staff of servants to do all the housework. But America has always had a tiny fraction of very rich people. What's new is not the difference between the 1% and the 99%. It's the difference between the upper middle class and those who fall below it, and the ways the upper middle class is finding to get their own kids up the ladder and then kick it out from under everybody else. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Richard V. Reeves is Senior Fellow in Economic Studies and co-director of the Center on Children and Families at the Brookings Institution. As an immigrant to the U.S. himself, he was surprised to discover that America has a class problem at least as vexing as the one he left behind in Britain, and one that could get worse unless we decide to make some changes. His new book is called Dream Hoarders: How the Upper Middle Class is Leaving Everyone Else in the Dust, Why That's a Problem, and What to Do About It. Richard, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me on.
You became a U.S. citizen a few months ago. You love it here, but you were disheartened to discover this is not a classless society.
Yeah, I don't think I was completely blind to some of the inequalities that the U.S. had in advance. But there is a bit of a feeling going from the frying pan to the fire here, in the sense that the class system in the U.K. is famous, right? Historically famous. People love Downton Abbey or the Crown, and it's kind of fun to sort of laugh at some of those hereditary principles at work in the old country, as it were. And I actually kind of grew up and then spent most of my adult life kind of hating the class consciousness of the U.K. But actually, what I've discovered in the U.S. through my research at Brookings, but also just in my sort of daily interactions and watching how people react, is that the class system just operates differently here. And it operates somewhat more beneath the surface. It's not as obvious, not as in your face. So you don't get thrown out for using the wrong fork or denied a job for not knowing which wine to have with fish or whatever. But it nonetheless does operate pretty ruthlessly and pretty effectively. And it does so in a sense more dangerously, precisely because it does so under this kind of veneer of classlessness. So people here love to believe that it's classless society, and you know how grateful I must be to have escaped all that horrible class system. And actually, I need to discover that actually, you know what, guys, you have a pretty serious class system here too, and in particular this top 20%. But as I say, kind of a bit more dangerous for the fact that there's a lot of sort of denial about that in the U.S. People don't like thinking about class in the U.S. in a way that you can't avoid thinking about it in the U.K.
I want to clarify some terms here, because it seems like every American identifies as middle class. But if we're really looking at the top fifth of the income ladder here, why call it the upper middle class instead of the upper class?
Well, one reason to do that is because that's what people themselves do. So you're right. I mean, depending which survey you choose, something nine in 10 Americans describe themselves as middle class. And then you break that down into different, like lower middle class, middle class, and upper middle class. And so something like 15% of the U.S. population define themselves as upper middle class. Only 1% right now, 1 or 2%, will define themselves as upper class. It's partly kind of self-defined term as a way to separate out, you know, what kind of middle? That's a pretty big middle. 90% is a big middle to be dealing with, and so kind of it's a meaningless term when it kind of encompasses that many people. And also, it's because that's where I see the kind of the break in inequality over the last two or three decades in the U.S. If you're looking at, if you want to say, look, which group in the income distribution are better off today relative to everybody else than they were 30 years ago, it's the top fifth. And then within the top fifth, there are differences too. But there's been almost no movement in terms of income inequality in the bottom 80%. Mm. So, you know, bluntly put, the gap between the poor and the middle, it hasn't really increased very much in the last 30 years. It's the gap between the top and everybody else where we've seen that kind of opening up. So both in terms of self-definition, but also the way I read the economic trends anyway, that seems to be where the kind of break point is.
There still might be a lot of people who think, well, I'm not upper middle class. I appreciated the fact that you delineated this with dollar amounts. So generally speaking, what amount of household income puts people into the upper middle class?
So to the very bottom of the top fifth nationally is now about $120,000 a year household income. The average for that group is 200,000, just a bit more than 200,000, and then obviously goes up kind of higher. But that's the kind of that's the entry. That's the very very bottom, if you like. And a lot of people will say, well, my income's a bit more than that. And I certainly don't feel upper middle class, and it will depend where you live and so on. But I also think that's kind of part of the problem is that we always tend to look up when we're making our own income comparisons and to think of ourselves as kind of poor by comparison to the people that we know or live with or hear about, rather than look actually quite hard at the income distribution. And the truth is that anybody who's got a household income that puts them comfortably into six figures is on the sort of winning side of the inequality trends of recent years rather than the losing one. And they may not recognize that or appreciate that. And I understand that. But it is also kind of just kind of what the facts tell us is that that's the group that's better off than it was 30, 40 years ago.
So this is the group whose wealth and privilege is growing fast enough to create that income gap that you mentioned. How and why have those divisions widened between the upper middle and the middle classes?
So right, that is the economic divide. So you know, just put some numbers on it. That top fifth of sort of since about 1980 have seen their collective income increase by about 4 trillion, whereas it's 3 trillion for the bottom 80%. So the top fifth have increased their income more than the rest of society put together. And the main reasons really are, it's the way I put it in the book, for the purposes of alliteration, are wages and wives. And so really this is sort of the big increases in earnings inequality. So actually just in terms of earnings, the inequality has grown even faster than in terms of income in some cases. And so it's just that people at the top are just earning a lot more, and particularly if they're college graduates, the returns to education have increased a lot. So if you get a good education, you get out of college and you get a good 4-year degree, then actually your earnings are higher than the equivalent was for someone like you 30, 40 years ago. So we're really seeing that kind of dispersion in the labor market, in the workplace between higher and lower paid. And then the second, wives, is that we now have many, many more higher earning women and college graduate women and higher educated women. And they tend to end up together. So what you then see is those two things compounding. So you see increased earnings inequality, a significant increase in the number of women who are doing really well as a result of the expansion of women's opportunities in education. Then you put those two together, which is the tendency of people to marry people like themselves. There's a stunningly unromantic term in the literature, which is assortative mating, which basically means marrying people like yourself. And that seems to be happening increasingly. And so you've got this kind of marrying within class as well. And so it's not just one college graduate tends to be two, and that tends to increase household income. Those two trends, I think, explain quite a lot of the separation.
There are lots of reasons people might support and have supported President Trump, but I was puzzled initially over the overwhelming support that he gets among many working class Americans. As a billionaire who, according to legend, had a chauffeur to drive him around on his paper route as a kid. But it's not the super wealthy that many people at the bottom of the economic ladder resent these days.
No, it does seem that that's the case. That the anger is obviously going in lots of different directions. It's slightly kind of Catherine Wheel effect of anger among some of the people who voted for President Trump, who would define themselves as middle class, or we might say working class. But certainly, of kind of certainly in this bottom 80% or in the sort of middle income distribution, and they're not angry at your rich. You're right. They're angry at the professionals. They're angry at upper middle class people. They're angry at doctors and lawyers and think tankers and journalists and radio hosts. And academics and so on, more so it seems than the rich. And what I think Donald Trump did rather brilliantly was to kind of position himself as sounding and looking quite middle class or even blue collar, calling it as he sees it, etc. And very much strongly in, he defined himself very much against the sort of social norms and courtesies, if you like, of the upper middle class. That seems to have really played very well with him, even though he's spectacularly rich himself. It does look as if the anger is more directed at this kind of broader class of people than it is at people who just got a lot of money. It's class, not just money.
I want to make it clear to people that you do stipulate here that race and ethnicity are, of course, still major issues in inequality in America. But I wonder what perspective you think we gain when we look at class mobility by itself.
Well, I am at pains to say that much of my other work has been focused specifically on race, and in particular the mobility patterns of African Americans are very, very different to white Americans in particular. But I think that for the purpose of this book in particular, I was very, I wanted to focus specifically on class, which of course overlaps strongly with race and has implications for race too. But in a way, I did want to think about this through more of a class lens, because I've observed, and I think there's some data to support this, that kind of particularly liberal upper middle class Americans are very often kind of actually pretty cosmopolitan, pretty supportive of greater diversity and so on in their neighborhoods and even in their schools and workplaces, and quite rightly under pressure to do so. It seems to be sort of a class division that seems to be operating here. And so, to put it, you know, unnecessarily bluntly in a way, so I think there's a lot of liberal whites in the upper middle class in the US that are perfectly happy to have, you know, neighbors and colleagues of all kinds of backgrounds and different colors, so long as they're well-educated and lawyers or the same class as themselves. And so you've got to think about both, I think. You've got to think about the interaction between class and race. I also did discover, though, and we may get into this a bit, that many of the institutions that are used to sort of help support class inequality actually have their roots in racial exclusion, not least some of the issues around housing and the regulation of the housing market and zoning in particular, but also things like legacy preferences in college admissions and so on. They're not explicitly race-based anymore, but they have racial consequences, but they're now being repurposed to serve sort of class ends as well as race ones. So the interweaving of race and class in this story is very interesting. But I did particularly want to get my readers to think about class and their own class position, because that actually, in a funny way, is a sort of less comfortable conversation in some ways than the necessary conversation, for obvious reasons, about race.
Yeah, I think what's really interesting about the work that you present here is that it confronts a lot of people with the fact who probably don't feel as if they have done anything wrong, that they have earned their privilege. They're not going out of their way to hurt anyone else, but in supporting only sort of their own families, they do that anyway.
Yeah, it's very interesting that the word meritocracy was actually born in the UK. It was a British sociologist, Michael Young, who wrote a book called The Rise of the Meritocracy as a warning against what would happen to a society that came to believe in itself as a meritocracy. But of course, the word then took on a completely different and much more positive purpose. And nowhere more so than in the US. And that word has been adopted into the US language. And, you know, Goldman Sachs, the first sentence in its mission statement is Goldman Sachs is a meritocracy. People use the word a lot here. And I think that in some ways it's getting in the way now of a more honest debate about inequality. And it's actually what Young warned about in his book from the 1950s, which is if people are convinced that their own position is entirely the result of their own merit, you know, their own hard work, their own brilliance and diligence, then it's much harder to persuade them they should part company with some of their earnings, some of their money, some of their advantages or opportunity to help others, because their natural reaction would be, no, hold on, I earned all of this. I deserve all of this. It's a meritocracy. And so I think that kind of can create a bit of a problem. It creates an empathy gap between those, the winners, who can convince themselves they won fair and square, and everybody else. And it's not to say that people shouldn't work hard and we shouldn't applaud those that do. I try and work hard and to be successful, and I want my kids to do the same. But it is to say that it's always a mixture of some of the advantages that we've enjoyed along the way, and particularly for those who are raised upper middle class or are upper middle class now, to just look pretty hard at the extent to which all of their success is a result only of their own brilliance. But I have discovered that actually it's not a very good way to make friends in the US. To start questioning people about whether or not their success is only the result of their own brilliance, because it's really pretty hardwired into successful people here that's why they're successful. And that's a good thing because it incentivizes people, but it's a bad thing because it then means that the only reason some people are unsuccessful must be that they didn't work as hard or they're not quite as clever as I am. And that can, I think, breed some callousness in public debate, which we're in danger of entering now.
There's so much astonishing research about the effect of the zip code that we live in. How do upper middle class communities become exclusionary zones even when there are not statutes written to keep them that way?
Well, most of the zoning is done at a local level, obviously with state oversight too, but it tends to be that it's a local government issue as to how you regulate land use and residential rules in your own area. And you see that in many, many cities across the US, including your own, where there's really it's quite contested, this issue about kind of opening up housing markets. And so really it is by using many of the zoning regulations that used to perhaps serve racist purposes to keep out people of different color. And very often you just leave them in place. And that has the effect of keeping out those people who don't have enough money to live there. Effectively, they're gated communities, but the gate is money rather than a physical one.
My guest is Richard V. Reeves of the Brookings Institution. We're talking about his book, Dream Hoarders, how the upper middle class is leaving everyone else in the dust, why that's a problem, and what to do about it. We'll resume the conversation in 2 minutes. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Support for the Think podcast comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program where you can distinguish yourself personally and professionally. More at smu.edu/DLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Richard V. Reeves, who is Senior Fellow in Economic Studies and co-director of the Center on Children and Families at the Brookings Institution. We're discussing his new book, Dream Hoarders, how the upper middle class is leaving everyone else in the dust, why that is a problem, and what to do about it. You can join us at 800-933-5372. Richard, I played that clip because you note that more than a third of Occupy Wall Street demonstrators who marched in 2011 had six-figure incomes. Do you think movements like Occupy, We Are the 99%, take the pressure off the upper middle class to look at how it might be contributing to suffering down the ladder?
I do. I think that the We Are the 99%, whilst it was a great slogan for a while, was actually quite damaging one in terms of trying to bring about more kind of progressive social change. And I think it's because what you did was you were able to kind of convince someone that's really very near the top of the income distribution, someone that's kind of really on the winning side in terms of economic inequality, that they're really just like an ordinary working Joe. You know, they're just a member of their hardworking middle class like everybody else. And that really we just need to point our finger upwards at the super, at the really rich. And I think that that misstates the nature of the economic problem. This is not to say that the top 1% haven't been doing very well. They have. They've been pulling away even faster. But also we should note that people move in and out of the top 1% quite regularly. Actually, It's quite a volatile category. So it's not like this fixed permafrost on top of society. Sometimes it's just kind of upper middle class people who have a particularly good year. You know, some of the other spouse gets a job and they go in or out of the top 1%. But also it's in terms of housing and education and the broader structure of society. It's just, I don't think, right to think about that as a purely 1% problem. And what it's done is it's made a politics of redistribution, or a kind of politics that asks more of people who are towards the top but not in the top 1%. It's just harder because they say, well, I'm not rich, it's them. it's them. And then, of course, frankly, you then get into the top 1% and they blame the top 0.1%. Who blame the top 0.1%? You know, there's always, you know, you said it's very nice to have a private jet. Well, I know people who kind of have to share a jet. And for them, that's, you know, they feel that humiliation.
They're slumming it, right?
But yeah, really are. Yeah, friends have a jet and then someone else has two jets, you know. And so there's always someone higher up the mountain. There's always somebody you can point to as richer than you. And that's a problem. It's natural. It's human nature. But it becomes a problem if we're so unequal that we're really only comparing ourselves to people around ourselves and, you know, and kidding ourselves that really this is just a top 1% problem. The problems of economic inequality and social inequality and separation in the U.S. are much deeper than just the top 1%.
So there are policies that we label middle class benefits, and the 529 college savings plan is a good example of this, that turn out to be almost exclusively for the upper middle class.
Yeah, the tax code in particular has this kind of all these sort of weird, like upside down tax subsidies in the sense that they go to people that don't need them the most. Of course, those people also pay more in tax, but then we give a bunch back through things like mortgage interest deduction, some of the subsidies around healthcare, but then also things like this 529 college savings plan, which basically just gives a quite a significant tax break in capital gains and in many states income tax to those who have the money to save significantly towards their kids' college. And it's one of those things that on paper just sounds great. Look, let's encourage saving. Let's kind of allow people, let's reward them for doing it. But the truth is that only people with pretty high incomes can really afford to save serious amounts of money. And they're the only ones that benefit from the capital gains tax deduction anyway. And so what you do, you end up with a tax break that's going to be costing us $4 billion a year within a certain period and costing us, I think, $20 billion over the next 10 years that almost exclusively goes to people in the top fifth of the income distribution. Doesn't really seem to actually encourage much saving. They just change the vehicles that they're saving through. It was just a handout, effectively, to the upper middle class. But when President Obama tried to do away with that tax break, not retrospectively, of course, but to just say, look, this is not a good way to spend our money, in 2015, there was uproar. They hadn't thought through the politics of it. They hadn't thought through that everybody analyzing, writing about, broadcasting about, and thinking about this policy was in the very group who are benefiting from it. So you have to prepare the ground better than they did. But also what I noticed was it was liberal Democrats, Chris Van Hollen, my congressman at the time, Nancy Pelosi from California, they really led the charge against this and said, you've got to kill this. And so Obama became the first president in living memory to kill an element of his own budget before he even got to Congress under pressure from the liberal wing of his own party. And that was a real moment for me. So I said, wow, okay, there's a sense of entitlement here around this, some of these benefits. But on paper, these are just handouts. That's why it was George Bush that passed this tax cut. And Bill Clinton vetoed it, a version of it, before that. And yet it now has become something that the American upper middle class genuinely feel entitled to. And as long as that's the case, then we've got no chance for broader reform.
Did you say the Obama family themselves put $250,000 into a 529 plan in a single year?
They did, yeah. They had, a windfall. And one of the other elements of this tax reform is that for 5 years at least, you can front load it without running into the gift tax laws that otherwise affect the ability of people to pass on money to their children. So it's really adding insult to injury, that rule. It's an unjustified addition to an unjustified break. But the Obamas did that. Yeah, they front loaded it. And of course, what it means is the capital gain is bigger, which means that the tax break is bigger. At the same time, President Obama was the only politician with the nerve recently to actually try and do something about it. He was unsuccessful, and it was a very unpleasant few days politically for the administration when he tried to do it. But, all credit to him, it was absolutely the right policy. The politics of it turned out to be pretty horrible, and I'm sure no one will go near it again for the foreseeable future. It'll just remain as a sort of standing embarrassment in the US tax code. But to me, it's come to symbolize a deeper problem, which is that there are people, you want to talk about real money, talk about the mortgage interest deduction, is that there's a class of people who genuinely are quite resistant to the idea that they should have to give anything up to help the bottom 80%. But unless they do, we're in real trouble in terms of getting anything like a level playing field for the next generation.
You quote Charles Murray here, who calls internships affirmative action for the advantaged.
Yes, there's lots to disagree with in what Charles Murray writes and says, but you can enthusiastically agree with that, or at least I can. Internships have become quite an important part of the labor market, especially for people who aspire to kind of professional jobs. One survey found that 3 in 5 graduating college seniors have had an internship, and employers rate them pretty highly because it obviously shows someone's got work experience. If they've worked with you, you've had a chance to see what they can do. And so you can see the attraction, particularly from the point of view of employers. They've really grown in the last 20 years. And because they've grown and become more important, the way they're allocated, the way they're distributed and supported becomes actually quite an important fact for opportunity in America. And what I observe is a huge number of unpaid internships, already half of them are unpaid. And also they're just handed out. People call them favor interns, where it's for a funder. So I'm at Brookings, I might get a call from a funder to say, oh, well, my niece needs an internship. Or, you're a congressman and one of your donors, big donors, wants to get his son an internship, and so on and so on. This happens everywhere. But that's actually kind of deeply unmeritocratic, deeply unfair. If these are important opportunities, then we should be very careful not to be handing them out on a grace and favor basis, or at least not do that and then pretend for a moment that the outcomes in society are the result of a fair competition, because that's a rigged competition.
Some people in this income bracket will send their kids to private schools, but others rely on public education. Why are public schools in upper middle class neighborhoods of the same school district better than those in working class communities?
Because they are able to attract higher quality teachers. That's one of the big differences. And really, teacher quality is the kind of that's the magic ingredient in terms of quality of education. Also, because if it's done on the basis of geographical area, if it's predominantly reasonably affluent children going to the school, then there are fewer resources having to go to social services or to helping kids with other problems they might have in order to learn. Those tend to get concentrated in other schools, so that improves the learning environment. And then also you get things like parafunding in the form of PTA funding. So you'll see really some of the kind of parent-teacher associations in some of these schools are able to raise quite a bit of money, which they're then able to use to buy playing fields, support teachers, music lessons, and so on. And so there's a whole kind of series of things that go into that equation. But really the kind of biggest one seems to be that it's just kind of, much easier to attract teachers to those schools. It's not by and large about money because, of course, the pay scales tend to be set by unions at a district level at least. It seems to be more about the ability, the capacity to kind of attract them because they'll find the kind of teaching environment to be a more conducive one. And, teachers are human. They respond to incentives and they think about their working environment. So they're able, in a sense, to kind of hoard the best teachers. Whereas if we're really serious about equalizing the playing field, of course, we'd want the best teachers in the toughest schools. and the worst teachers in the better school, in the richer schools, because there they don't matter as much. Actually, a high-quality teacher really makes a difference to kids, but makes a particular difference to kids from a poorer background. So in a sense, a really good teacher is somewhat wasted on my kids, but would actually could make a huge difference if they're in the front of the classroom of kind of poorer kids. But that's kind of embedded in the way that education is organized here. And then lastly, of course, the way that this is more at a district level, property taxes fund education. And so what that means is that if you've got a kind of stronger tax base in terms of property funding, then you have more money to spend on schooling in the first place.
All right, let's jump on the phones here. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. We have Harold calling from McKinney. Hi, Harold.
Hello. I would like to replace the term income inequality with something else, because that term has kind of a stigma of those of us who use that term wanting something that we haven't really earned or don't deserve or makes us look greedy. The issue, I think, the real issue is that people work very, very hard and don't have enough money just for daily living. And
what do you think about that, Richard?
Well, I think that's a good point about the kind of it's a living wage point, I think. I mean, I think it's the upper middle class, the people that I'm mostly worried about, they work hard. This is not a leisure class by any means. So I then think the inequality comes in what are the returns you get from that hard work? And if you're in the middle quintile or lower down the income distribution, you're also working pretty hard too. Otherwise, you probably wouldn't be there. But we're seeing this such a big gap in wages now, that the wages that are brought home by a couple or a breadwinner much lower are just simply much, much lower than for people at the top, and lower than they were in the past, relatively speaking. So you're seeing this really growth and expansion. So I think that's part of the problem. I think that this sense of being squeezed, the sense of living paycheck to paycheck, is actually a problem for people. And then they're worried about things like the cost of college, and they become really worried about things like the cost, can they afford to send their kids to college and so on. So I think that has quite significant knock-on consequences. So the question then is, how can we increase the income and security of people who are at the middle and bottom of the labour market? And that can be through a series of policies and interventions. But guess what? We need resources for that. Where are we going to get the resources from? From the people who aren't struggling so much. Who are they? The upper middle class. But they won't because they feel that they've come by it. So the wheel comes full circle, I think. And that's my real fear, is that we're approaching a point where actually politically it will become nigh impossible to do the kinds of investment that we need to do for the bottom 80 or bottom 50%.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Richard Reeves of the Brookings Institution. We're talking about his new book, Dream Hoarders, How the Upper Middle Class is Leaving Everyone Else in the Dust, Why That is a Problem, and What to Do About It. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. Let's go on the phone now to Tom in Houston. Hello, Tom.
Hi there. I have a question and a comment. One is, is it true, I've heard people say, that the income inequality today in the U.S., the gap between the wealthiest and the poor, is greater than the inequality than the same metric in Great Britain at the time of the U.S. Revolution? And my other comment is that the notion of achieving a level playing field for the next generation was something you mentioned before. I don't think is, in my view, just something about altruism. I think it's almost about self-preservation. I think the more the gap grows, and the more the have and the have-nots don't have, at some point the have-nots are just going to get really angry, and to quote a TED Talk that you're probably familiar with, the pitchforks are going to be coming. And so I think it's not just about altruism and a just society. I think it should be about the wealthiest need to acknowledge that it's about self-preservation.
All right, thanks, Tom. Let's get a response for you.
Great question. So I'll take them in reverse order, that one, the pitchfork one first. I mean, President Obama famously said, didn't he, to Wall Street, I'm the only thing standing between you and the pitchforks. I think you're right, Tom, about in principle, in theory, about the self-preservation argument. I think that lots of people, back to the we are the 99% thing, think that they won't be on the sharp end of the pitchfork. They tend to think, no, it'll just be the Wall Street bankers. Well, I'm not so sure that's true. So they may be more vulnerable to pitchforks than they think they are at the moment. But I also think that the arguments about this is in your own interests and this is about self-preservation and the kind of society you want, and you can, I'm not sure they're working. I'm not sure they have worked in recent years. I think if they're going to work, then it perhaps would have worked under President Obama, especially in his early years. And so that may be right, Tom, but I'm trying to do something totally different, which is to say, look, I'm actually, I think a lot of this is in your self-interest, but I'm going to be a little bit more honest perhaps than some of the people are saying. Some of this is not in your immediate self-interest. Some of this is just the right thing to do. Some of this is just about basic fairness. And that's really not a conversation that many people are willing to have anymore. You know, everything has to be, no, it's in your interest. It's in your interest. Well, not everything can be in everyone's interest all the time, and that's part of it. As for your first question, and I don't know the answer. I will tell you as a researcher, I'll distrust any income statistics from that long ago, the U.S. Revolution. But I will say that the U.S. income inequality, depending on how you measure it, but is higher than any time since before the Second World War, since the 1930s. It looks now as if actually the period in the post-war years, in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, was the exception. Actually, was that, you know, America was exceptionally equal during those years, and they're now reverting back to a kind of pre-war level of income inequality that probably was more common, actually. There was something unusual about those post-war years, which now seems to have come to an end. But as to a time of the U.S. Revolution, I don't know. Take a better historian than me.
This term in the book that will really stick with me is opportunity hoarding. The way that upper middle class parents stack the deck for their own kids at the expense of kids born on lower rungs of the ladder. We are told from every corner of society that we're supposed to do the very best for our kids and give them the most possible opportunities. Have upper middle class parents somehow just put that advice on steroids?
Yes, a great way to think about it. The question then becomes that where's the line? And I've really tried to struggle with this honestly in the book and in my kind of conversations. It's one of the most common criticisms that will be made in my argument, which is look, the most natural thing in the world is to want to do everything you can for your kids. And don't we want more parents to do that? We want parents to emulate the upper middle class. And that's been a criticism that I've had quite a bit. And I actually take that very seriously. And I agree with it. I've got three kids. I've worked very hard to try and help them to be successful. I have 529 college savings plans. I actually take the tax break from it and give it to an educational charity. That's how I deal with the cognitive dissonance created by it. The question becomes, where's the line, right? Where's the line between natural parental preference for your kids and wanting the very best for them and rigging the market in their favor and starting to get to the point where it's like, oh, isn't that kind of cheating? And that's a very, very hard line to draw. Just because it's hard to draw, though, doesn't mean it's not there. And it's drawn in different ways in different places at different times. So it can shift. There does need to be a limit in a society to the natural preference of parents for their own kids to do well. Otherwise, then it's just a Darwinian dog-eat-dog society. And I don't think many of us really want that, not deep down.
Richard V. Reeves is Senior Fellow in Economic Studies and co-director of the Center on Children and Families at the Brookings Institution. His new book is called Dream Hoarders: How the Upper Middle Class is Leaving Everyone Else in the Dust, Why That is a Problem, and What to Do About It. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening master's program for working professionals. You can apply now for the fall of 2017. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Richard V. Reeves. He's Senior Fellow in Economic Studies at the Brookings Institution and author of Dream Hoarders: How the Upper Middle Class is Leaving Everyone Else in the Dust, Why That is a Problem, and What to Do About It. You can join us at 800-933-5372 or find us on Twitter at KERAThink. Richard, one economist told you flat out, the higher education system in this country takes the inequality given to it and then magnifies it.
Yes, that's actually not my quote, is the one you just read out. Anthony Carnevale, who's from Georgetown, says that it's an inequality machine, college education. And that does seem to be the case. The complexity of the system is part of the problem, but you sort pretty quickly into, first of all, whether you go to college at all, but then if you do go to college, which the majority now do in one form or another, what kind of college do you go to? And there's a very big difference between the social background of those going to four-year versus two-year colleges. Then do you stay in college? You know, are you there a year, kind of 2 years later, do you complete? And then within selective colleges, you also see big class gaps too. And so the four-year selective sector now, 70% of their students are from the top 20% of the income distribution. And so they're majority upper-middle-class campuses, if you use my terminology. The non-upper-middle-class people on those campuses are in the minority. And that is not getting better. Those trends are not moving in a more equal direction, if anything, in some cases getting slightly worse in terms of class, notwithstanding the efforts of many institutions. And then, of course, given the returns you get to your earnings and to your degree, if you've got a four-year degree, that then bakes in the inequality that we see in the labour market. So that piece between K-12 and the labour market, which is the post-secondary system, really does seem to be one of the most effective cogs in the kind of class reproduction machine in the US, more so, I think, than in other countries.
Let's be clear here. For the math to work, if some people from the lower middle and middle middle classes are to move up into that top 20%, by definition, some people in the top 20% will have to move down. Can you talk a little bit about why you're so passionate about some downward mobility from the upper middle class?
Well, I'm not sure that I want to be described as passionate about downward mobility. It's, you know, I talked about some of the ways to make yourself unpopular in the US, and this is perhaps the best way to become really ensure you're never invited back around, is to talk about the need for downward mobility, right? And then we sort of joke among friends, is like, well, let's just decide which of our kids we're going to nominate to kind of take one for the team. Which of your kids is going to be downwardly mobile? One of my kids actually comes home with his report card and says, Dad, I have good news and bad news. The good news is you're always saying we need downward mobility. the bad news is, here's my report card. But it's really a matter of math. You know, it's just from a relative mobility point of view, if we think about just this 20%, definitionally you can only have 20% of the population in the top 20%. And so if we do want more people moving in, it's just an unavoidable mathematical fact that you need more people moving out. Now, that's not in and of itself something that anyone would be necessarily in favor of at an individual level. But as a society, I think we should be in favor of that. I don't think anybody should be comfortable with the idea of a society where the people who are born at the top or automatically staying at the top. We do want downward mobility, relatively speaking. We also want everyone to get better off, to lower the stakes. But it's actually a very uncomfortable conversation to have with people. But it just seems to me it is necessary then to look at the ways in which status is perpetuated at the top. And if it's all done fair and square, no one's rigging anything, there are no institutions that give you an unfair advantage and it's just the way of the world, well, that's one thing. But that's not what I observe. I observe that the top is stickier in the US than elsewhere, more perpetuation of class at the top. And that is partly for some of the reasons we've talked about, through the way the housing market works, the way K-12 works, the way college works, and so on. So it's not the result of a free and fair competition. It's the result of a set of institutions and structural inequalities that actually help kids like mine, who are born upper middle class, to remain in the upper middle class. And some of the ways that they end up doing that are not fair. And that's where things get really tricky. But it's also where I think we need to do some of the necessary work. And it's moral work as much as policy work.
How do the relatively low rates of downward mobility from upper middle class families affect support for policies that would seek to benefit less fortunate families?
Well, I worry a lot about that. I worry that if you become quite confident that you're not going to be downwardly mobile and your kids are not going to be too downwardly mobile, then you might feel somewhat differently about your support for institutions that predominantly support those who have fallen on hard times. You know, so how strongly am I going to support, you know, universal healthcare or food stamp program, for example, if I feel pretty confident that I'm not going to need them and pretty confident my kids aren't going to need them? And so I think one of the advantages, if you like, of the risk of downward mobility, and it sounds odd to put it like that, but are that we might then support the safety net more. Like, if we don't think you're going to fall into that safety net and you don't think your kids are going to fall into that safety net, then maybe you're not so worried about it withering away. And so actually then inequality and lack of mobility starts to reinforce itself, because the more confident the people at the top can be that they're pretty secure at the top, then the less likely they might be to support the kinds of policies which will ask them to pay more for people who are currently not them and who are poorer than them, but in the future world might be them or might be their children. You know, maybe my kid will actually need to be on food stamps for a while or unemployment insurance or something. And so we probably want it there just in case. But so then I think it could become a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy, which is you undermine the institutions that might promote mobility because we don't have much equality. So that, in that sense, I think inequality, I know as Harold didn't like income inequality as a term, but I do think this gap actually then might start to kind of get a bit locked in. And I'm worried about that kind of lock-in effect right now.
All right, let's go back to the phones. This time we have Ben calling from DeSoto. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Very well.
Great show today. My question or comment relates directly to that safety net. My wife and I were talking about this the other day. I'm white, she's black, and one of the differences that we had growing up is that I had a safety net. I could make some mistakes in my career. I could make some mistakes, you know, in buying a house or buying a house in the wrong area, whereas she grew up much more tentative. And so the risk-taking ability, the entrepreneurial factor wasn't there. And we've talked about this in the kids that we teach. And then added to that, the fact that so many bankruptcies are directly related to health-related issues, then without the Affordable Care Act, without, you know, some kind of a safety net of health care, it erodes or undermines even more the transportability or the ability of a person to try new things, be more entrepreneurial.
Really interesting points, Ben. Thank you for your call.
They're great questions, Ben. Thank you. And I do think that, you know, when you have a society where money matters as much as it does in the US, and by that I mean for things like healthcare and housing, because they're not socialized, it does mean that the risk is higher. It does mean that you've got more of your eggs in one basket, in this case, kind of your income, your earnings, and that creates quite a bit of insecurity. I think it's one argument for making money matter less in the sense by making many of these could be public goods. But I think this point about risk that you made, Ben, is absolutely fascinating, and I think a lot about this. Bob Putnam has written a book, Our Kids, and he now talks about the airbags that deploy, right? Everyone crashes sometimes, but the airbags deploy. And around upper-middle-class kids, there's a lot of airbags. They get into trouble, then they get counseling, they get a lawyer, they get a lot of help. People kind of come around, they kind of help them to overcome their mistake and not for it to be the end of the world. But if you don't have those airbags, then actually the crash can be pretty bad and it might be quite hard to recover from. And I think that one of the goals of public policy is to create sorts of airbags, if you like, so that people can make mistakes, that they can have things go wrong, which does tend to happen for pretty much everybody at one case or another. And for the airbags not to be dependent on the income of your parents, otherwise you do become risk averse. I think that upper middle class kids actually can take more risks. They can move to a city and try that job out. And if it doesn't work out, it's not the end of the world. Mum and dad will look after them. And so actually what you see then is that the capacity to take risk, maybe even go to college, you know, taking on some debt to go to college, that's a risk too. Maybe if you're not so sure about money, you don't take that risk. But actually the capacity and willingness to take on risk with some certainty that if the risk doesn't pay off, it's not the end of the world, that's hugely important to America's sense of itself. And if we lose that, if we lose the sense that you can take a risk without the downside of that, meaning the end of thing, I think your point about entrepreneurism, Ben, is exactly right, then what we'll see is that risk-taking and entrepreneurialism will become also hoarded by the upper middle class. And that is bad news for everybody.
What would happen to homeownership if we were to eliminate the mortgage interest refund?
So I don't know what happened to the overall amount of homeownership. You know, I'm enough of an economist to think that, you know, if you're subsidizing something, then you're bound to get more of it. What tends to happen is you get more expensive versions of it in the US. So the current mortgage interest deduction increases the depth of home ownership more than it does the breadth. And what I mean by that is it encourages people to be able to buy more expensive houses, especially more affluent people, than it does to encourage very, very, very many more people to buy. Clearly, there'll be some people who can buy who couldn't otherwise under the mortgage interest deduction, but not that many. Mostly, it just helps people to buy really expensive houses and get a big subsidy for doing it. So I don't think it would have much effect on the overall coverage of home ownership. What it would do, of course, depending on how you phased it, is it would have an impact on the value of property, and that's why some people really worry about it. If you phase it out, there's no reason to think there'd be some sort of horrible, great sucking sound in the property market. But I think in the long run, it'd be very good for the economy because it would mean that people's choices about where to invest weren't distorted. People wouldn't be quite so frantic about the value of their house because it's their only kind of wealth asset. They wouldn't cling to these deductions so much. Renting would become perhaps more of an option. And overall, housing would become more affordable, which is really what I think a lot of people need. So the mortgage interest deduction is this huge distortion in the market now that it doesn't really increase home ownership. What it does is it increases kind of wealthy home ownership and increases the overall cost of housing, which is in the long run to our broader detriment. You know, we know that it's affecting economic growth, that people can't afford to move to the cities where the growth is because housing's too expensive. And to have something that's very expensive and being subsidized to this level, that's not good economics.
Something else, you're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Something else, Richard Reeves, that you write about in the book that we really haven't touched on is you would like to see more, I guess, social programs to send home visitors out into lower income communities to help parents understand maybe some of the strategies that, that more fortunate parents have been using to benefit their children.
Yeah, I think there's a parenting gap in the U.S. You know, I think that parents who are particularly kind of very well-educated parents, college-educated parents, really invest quite a lot of time and effort in parenting their children. And the evidence is that that's pretty good for those kids. Obviously, you can overdo it. There's all the helicopter parenting stories that many of us can share. So it can be overdone. But as a general proposition, you know, creating a stable home environment and spending time engaging with your kids is very good for those children. And that is actually that's becoming more widespread now. You're starting to see some of the elements, like reading to your children, for example. Actually, there's a bit of a closing of the gap, more parents from lower income backgrounds doing it. But as a proposition, particularly those who are in, let's say, maybe the bottom 20% and so on, many of whom are single parents, many of whom are out of work, it's actually quite hard. Parenting becomes quite a tough job at that point. And many of those parents actually welcome the help to develop their own skills as parents, welcome someone like a home visitor helping them come in to do it. And those programs have been reasonably well evaluated. They're funded on a bipartisan basis up until now. I'm crossing every finger that that will continue to be the case next year when Congress decides again. These home visiting programs, which are very common everywhere else in the world, most other countries in the world, where you're just helping parents, not necessarily just low-income parents, but parents who are sort of struggling, help to equip them with the skills and the knowledge that they need to become more effective parents, seems to have quite a good, they're well evaluated. They seem to have a pretty good impact on the kids' outcomes. And so I'm very much hoping that there'll be more investment in that area in the future rather than less.
We should also invest, you say, in ensuring that people don't become parents unless they are willing and ready to.
Yeah, that's a simple claim that it's good for people to have access to affordable, if not free, effective contraception. The historic link in the past between marriage and sex has reduced. 95% of Americans now have sex before they get married. It's absolutely the norm. But actually, the link between having sex and having babies, which is a harder one, actually hasn't done so well in the US. And particularly in the US, there are huge class gaps in access to and use of effective forms of contraception so that people can actually plan when they have their kids. And this is obviously a very difficult issue. It's a difficult moral issue. It's a difficult policy issue. And right now, we're seeing significant movements in the other direction, at least at a federal level, away from access to family health. But it does seem to me that that's a hugely important part of kind of ensuring kids have the best start in life, which is to make sure their parents are ready for them and that they want them and that they're not the result of an accident. And that's, you know, it's frustrating, I think, for those in the policy community when there are just such effective tools available, including long-acting reversible contraception, which are absolutely the norm among upper-middle-class parents, you know, are so hard to get and expensive to get for those who are less affluent, and that just strikes me as bad policy.
Can't let you go without asking about David Brooks of the New York Times responding last week to your book with a column in which he tried to empathize with a less educated friend's struggle to fit into a fancy sandwich place and sort of the environment there. He ended up sounding, I think unintentionally, quite elitist and out of touch. Is he an example of the kind of learning more of us have ahead of us in order to recognize and confront our own privilege?
Well, I think it was an honest effort on David's part to actually disagree with me and say that it's not structure, it's not these economic institutions, it's culture. There are cultural gaps and there are kind of cultural codes. He chose a sandwich shop as his example. Candidly, I didn't know most of the terms that he referred to, so I would be in trouble too if David Brooks is right. So I think it was perhaps an infelicitous example of a point which nonetheless is valid. And you know what? If you're producing two or three columns a week, then maybe you're allowed the odd paragraph that doesn't quite meet the mark, but social media doesn't let you get away with that anymore, does it?
Richard V. Reeves is Senior Fellow in Economic Studies at the Brookings Institution and author of Dream Hoarders, How the Upper Middle Class is Leaving Everyone Else in the Dust, Why That is a Problem and What to Do About It. Richard, thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you, Chris, and thank you to the questioners as well. I appreciate it.
I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.